KBOO Community Radio is proud to host the class Hip Hop Past, Present, and Future, and Your Place in It with Mike Crenshaw on Saturday, January 27th at 4 p.m. at KBOO in Portland. This class will explore hip hop history locally and nationally, KBOO hip hop programming, how hip hop influences art, culture, and political consciousness, rhyme writing and production, and how liberation struggles have contributed to hip-hop culture. Again, that's Hip-Hop Past, Present, and Future and Your Place in It with Mike Crenshaw on Saturday, January 27th at 4 p.m. at KBOO, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the 35th Annual Real Music Film Festival, taking place January 12th through January 30th at the Northwest Film Center. New works and classics are featured this year, including Charles Mingus, Triumph of the Underdog, Chavela, Long Strange Trip, The Untold Story of the Grateful Dead, The Big Beat, Fats Domino and the Birth of Rock and Roll, and many, many more. Again, that's the 35th Annual Real Music Film Festival, taking place January 12th through the 30th. All screenings are at the Witzel Auditorium in the Portland Art Museum, 1219 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland.
Oh, your masters of lies, who kill all the truth, who spread all the hatred and poison the roots, who hide behind TVs, computers, and spies. I just want you to know that I see through your lies. Oh, you suck up all the money and you leave us with crumbs. They expect us to be grateful, but we're not that dumb. You feed on the poor and you leave them for dead, and we know that your hunger can never be fed. I'll find all your mansions and your golf courses too. How rich are your relatives? You've got quite a few. Your money uncountable, investments unknown. You're a mystery until your cover gets blown. Now I know who you love and who you despise. You love yourself first with a narcissist's eyes, and you despise anybody who calls out your game. Well, I'm calling you now, so take your best aim. You were born into money, so how would you know? We're just here to be used for your revenue flow. Like a fistful of numbers, like something to earn. Yeah, but some of those numbers are starting to turn. Like a baby in swaddling, you suck on your thumb. But your thumb is a cell phone, that's how it gets done. With your midnight explosions, your rants and your bile, is it any wonder we become so reviled? Go out into the world and see who we are. A laughing stock nation under a dangerous star. Armed and unstable with a tyrant's design. It's come to this, yes, it's the end of the line. And I hope that you fall and you fall so hard that you cannot be saved from your dead house cards. With your memory buried so no one will know how this once great nation could fall so low. We will go on without you, yes, we will survive. Out into the future, our beauty will thrive. With our face to the sun and our backs to the rain, and no one will ever remember your name. With our face to the sun and our backs to the rain, yeah, no one will ever remember your name.
Good morning. This is Wednesday Talk Radio here on KBOO Community Radio. My name is Paul Rowland. Thanks for tuning in or continuing to listen, as the case may be. That was Jim Page. Great Jim Page from Seattle, Washington, with his new CD, A Handful of Songs, with his sort of remake in some fashion of Dylan's classic Masters of War with his Masters of Lies. And Jim is going to be at the annual Winter Folk benefit concert for Sisters of the Road coming up January 27th, this weekend, at the Alberta Rose Theater. Yes, Jim Page and many, many other excellent folk singers. All right, so I'm here by myself again. This is a talk show, a conversation. I like to challenge people to engage in a sustained conversation. Don't have too many opportunities to do that collectively. This is one that we offer you. And I often have guests. Today, I'm going to continue, in some sense, the conversation that I started last week. Very, very difficult, complex discussion on postmodernism. Has to do with the nature of truth, the nature of reality, universalism. All these big concepts seem like big philosophical concepts. You know, I did study philosophy. I'll put that out there. Whether that's an advantage or disadvantage, I couldn't say. I do think that there is something to the old idea that a liberal arts education helps make you think for yourself. And I believe it did help do that for me. I guess maybe I'm not the best judge if, you know, kind of putting oneself out there as a public intellectual way is kind of fraught with difficulty. But yes, I studied philosophy at a highfalutin Eastern University, Wesleyan University. I was privileged. My dad had a decent federal government job that allowed him to pay for his children's somewhat much more affordable so-called higher education. Now, I think someone with my dad's salary, I guess even a commensurable salary now, would have a much more difficult time seeing how these university tuitions have skyrocketed, and so many people are forced to hostage their future to their education by taking out student loans. Anyway, I did not have to do that. I was very fortunate. Whether I used my education in the best way, I certainly haven't practiced it in terms of a profession. But this, I do think that there is something to being challenged to confront, in some sense, you know, to confront the founding ideas of quote Western civilization, you know, in a way, going back to Plato and Aristotle and through the Enlightenment and the Romantic period and modern philosophy. There's not much time in one's life, workaday life, to do that. So to be able to take out time and engage with ideas, I think, is a benefit. I believe it has benefited me. It's honed my critical thinking skills, and I think critical thinking skills are what are being eroded by the trends in modern current education, privatization, testing. It can be summed up in the idea of a shortcuts, something I've been thinking a lot about, that a lot of this is a lot of what capitalism is all about is taking shortcuts. and to profit everything on the altar of short-term profit. Anyway, so I've already put out a lot of things. This is a talk show, as I said, 503-231-8187. 503-231-8187. If there are people who were listening last week, I would encourage people who called in last week or who call in regularly just to think about hesitating a little bit before calling in. Let other people have a chance. And of course, if no one's calling in, feel free to call in. Looks like we've already got a caller. I haven't fully introduced the topic. I've sort of thrown out my own story in bits and pieces. I know it might seem a bit odd. I already kind of have this, you know, monopoly of the airwaves, as it were, for this hour here, and then sort of to talk about myself. But I think it's important. I think we don't have enough chance to really get to know each other. Again, I don't think we realize how strange and different the culture that we live in is compared to cultures, say, where I lived in Italy for over a decade, where people in my little valley totally grew up together and, you know, had a common shared basic worldview based upon the fact that they had strong shared experiences. We're so heavily individualized now that we, you know, a lot of us, we, you know, listen to our own particular music, have our own particular tastes, and we've really lost a sense of a shared social intimacy, I guess, as it were. The English language also has its flaws in that regard. These kind of things that it's difficult to be self-conscious of because it's difficult to step outside of the frame of reference that we're in. So I've been fortunate to be able to not just have this privileged education, whereas, you know, able to engaged with all these people. Wow, we got a whole stack of callers already. So I'm going to cut this a little short. But so, yeah, I had that experience, and I had some very strong experiences with native people and culture here in the Pacific Northwest, which gave me a very different vantage point. I had some very powerful experiences of struggle, experiences in ceremony. I also had very strong experience in the fight to preserve the Pacific Northwest ancient forests. So I had very strong experience in the original ecology and understanding the original ecology of this part of the world, which is another frame of reference. And then I lived in another country in the mountains of Northwest Italy for about 14 years off and on, which gave me another frame of perspective. And I think these America firsters, it's exactly part of the problem, is they don't, all they know is this debased social reality, unfortunately, that we are all living in. As we all know, the mass culture of, you know, to make it very simplistic, McDonald's and strip malls and television, commercial society, all that. And it's very, the power of this culture that we swim in to keep us distracted, keep us from seeing what it really is for many people, it's very difficult to achieve that. And I think people react against this. Part of the anti-intellectualism in American culture is because people might feel that they have been left out, that they don't have the tools. You know, this might seem a bit of an elitist approach, but I think that, you know, quote, Trumpism is certainly a reaction against the challenges of people of color, people of varied genders, identities, women, challenges to the kind of core white supremacist patriarchal culture to just to make it very simple formula there, but there's a lot to that. I certainly share that analysis that this is a country founded on white supremacy and patriarchy and heteronormative sexuality, and that those are fighting a rear guard action against the challenges that have arisen to their dominance. So I put a lot out there, but we've got some other people who want to have their say. So let's go to Tom. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Hello.
Good morning.
Yeah, go ahead. You're on the air.
Italy. Let's call it the blueprint and the template of empire as we know it, coming from Rome.
Well, and there's Italy and there's Italy. I mean, you know, where I was, actually, I lived in a very minority community that actually was rather separate from the mainstream of Italian history. But anyway.
Well, it's okay. I mean, considering, Italy was in Europe, and they went through their dark ages, and they had their feudalism, and at some point they went through their Renaissance. Not many of us are as smart as you. Not many of us is lucky enough to have a education like yourself. But you know, some of us are a little self-taught, and we start to understand this postmodernism in relation to our mediocrity as humans. And how we as human beings have to reconcile our place on this planet, and how this technical thing we call the Industrial Revolution is kind of new in relation to our advancement as human beings. So it's like we're in a conundrum, but we're in another problem too, and that's the mediocrity and how we're going to deal with it.
Just say what you mean by mediocrity.
I mean, you know, humans as people, we can be as feral as an animal, or we can be as advanced as any advanced being can be. But it's all about that nature and nurture thing, you know? I mean, here, we how about this? How about, Let's think of an ape, and let's think about how intelligent an ape is, and then let's give that ape an Uzi, and let's see what that ape can do with it. It might eventually hurt itself. So we're talking concepts. My grandmother learned Latin in high school as a part of her curriculum about 80 years ago. So the mediocrity I'm talking about is like pulling human beings down to the lowest common denominator and realizing at some point that if you can pull a human being down to the lowest common denominator, and if you can maintain your humanity, think about the control you can have. You know? Mm-hmm. The McDonald's and the strip malls, you know, and the flat phones and the instant cereals. And instant rice, and everything's instant, no time. And let's not talk about the attack on the family structure, something you brought up, remember?
Uh-huh.
These things are being pulled away. We started out with the nuclear family in this country, but, you know, you're from the old country. There's something called the extended family, you know? So it's like, how do we reconcile all of this, you know? How do we do it? I mean, I'm not as smart as you. I didn't come.
Oh, come on.
My dad didn't have the money to send me to a college, but, you know, I'm literate. So I can say, you know, what matters. How do human beings deal with this technology that's probably advancing as we devolve emotionally?
Well, let's stick with that idea. That's something that I resonate with, that the idea of technology not being necessarily a you know, this idea of human progress that we seem to connect with the advances in technology. So you see a connection between technological sophistication and our own diminishment in some sense?
Well, let's look at what consumerism really is, as opposed to evolution. You know, I mean, we get these devices, and if it's not like the computer today was the transistor radio of yesterday, was the mechanical devices before then. But how does that affect our intelligence, and what is it about intelligence that we feel like we're losing? Why are we losing it? I mean, my own personal opinion is that when you make a person lose their intelligence, you make them lose their freedom and their sense of freedom.
Well, I think the connecting freedom and intelligence, I see it as being, you know, the ability to be able to solve problems for ourselves, I think, is what is diminished. And I think, you know, the idea of, you know, that you can use your cell phone as a calculator, you know, the idea of using calculators as opposed to long math, you know, those are old examples. But I think there's a very subtle level in which, you know, well, just moving around the city using a GPS as opposed to, we sort of lose our own sense of orientation in the world. And we sort of rely more and more upon machines, and we sort of delegate our own innate abilities to machines.
Well, I could say this. When I was growing up, my dad taught me how to tear an engine down and put it back together.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
But today, people don't do that anymore.
Well, now we got these super sophisticated computerized things that we have no control of whatsoever, yeah.
We're still dealing with 1945 technology. We still drive cars. We still use diesel generators and diesel trucks. So someone has to fix these. And once upon a time, it was normal for people to fix these things themselves. So nowadays, it's becoming lesser and lesser and lesser. So now you have this small group, maybe like the Silicon Valley types, and then a regular person. And these Silicon Valley types, they'll know how to take a computer apart and put it back together like me and my dad used to put a V12 together. But now look at what we got. You know?
Hey, listen, Tom, this is a really interesting conversation. I would like to actually continue with it, but we have a full stack of callers and more coming on. So I'm going to have to let that thought go there, and I appreciate your calling in.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Next up, if Lou is still waiting patiently, go ahead, Lou, you're on the air.
Hey, so it sounds like you're asking pretty good evocative questions based on people phoning in already between sociology, anthropology, and culture issues.
Uh-huh.
At Portland State, we had a meeting, short meeting yesterday on organizing, but we tried to not necessarily tie in exactly to what you've been raising as evocative questions, but we mentioned three people and how familiar people were with Ursula Le Guin, who died a couple days ago, Portland's most famous writer, I would argue, who talked a lot about alternate culture and alternate politics, feminist as well as socialist. Ursula Le Guin, Richard Hofstadter, and John Reed. So I don't know if you offhand see any connections with those folks or have read some of their stuff or know about them.
A little bit, all three, yeah.
Well, Hofstadter, in particular, from what you just said, he wrote a number of books, but one of them was Anti-Intellectualism in American Life. So that hits on the whole Trump, Republican, McDonald's paradigm. Le Guin, particularly in what I think is her best book, I mean, she's famous for Left Hand of Darkness, of course, and she's a Portland science fiction writer. She died on Monday. She's 88. She also worked on activist organizing projects. But The Dispossessed starts with the idea of a wall, so it's almost exactly, that's why we did this meeting, on Trump and Trump's America First so-called ideology. And then John Reed, some people at the meeting hadn't heard of John Reed in some ways, and you may know tons about John Reed, but John Reed's the only American to be buried in the Kremlin Wall. He covered the Mexican-American War and then afterwards wrote 10 Days That Shook the World about the Russian Revolution.
And another Portlander.
Yeah, well, more well, lived hopefully here, anyway. At one point more famous than Tanya Harding became. But yeah, in terms of the things that you've mentioned so far, I guess my thought would be, and since you have a lineup of people phoning in terms of I guess practical applications, do you think in terms of things that people can do in Portland at the moment? Local elections is something important to keep track of in terms of city council or state senate, or even on the sort of stuff that it sounds like you're talking about today, culture. It seems like with awards and movies in culture, there's a fair debate now about which movies are doing well out of Hollywood. For example, Shape of Water versus Three Billboards, etc. Do you think either of those are useful tangents to try to apply some of your critical thinking ideas on at the moment?
Well, it's all good. It's all good. Sure. I mean, I think, I don't know. You've got the floor, so.
Well, in terms of local elections, which we always try to focus as an organizing group, we being Progressive Student Union and Portland Great Panthers, Transit Riders Union, Tenant Rights Project. In terms of local elections, Casey Jama is running for rent raising Rod Monroe's Senate seat. Rod Monroe's the Blue Dog Democrat. There's a primary election with three candidates. Rod's the incumbent. He's the person who blocked rent control getting passed in the last legislative session. He's a landlord, and the governor was going to sign the bill. The House of Representatives passed it, but it got blocked in the Senate, despite Oregon being one of the very blue coastal states overall. And in city council, we're trying to keep track of city council because we think students in particular tend to not, despite being very active with Portland resistance and a number of liberation struggles in Portland, necessarily think either that electoral politics or that local stuff matters. And for city council, we in particular are trying to promote Joanne Hardesty for city council. She's running for an open seat. She's a longtime KBOO person, although not in the air now because of the election. NAACP, police reform, housing.
Okay, well, Lou, I think you know, so the election is a ways off, and I think this is an important conversation. Whoop! He just got off the phone rapidly, and I was willing to hear him out a little bit more. But anyway, we've got a full slate of callers. We are turning into an open forum here, which is good. William, go ahead. You're on the air. If you're Karen, go ahead.
Oh, hi. Well, I don't know if I'm thinking of the things that you wanted us to talk about, but when you raised the issue of how do we know what we know, is it okay to talk about that? In the sense of, do we look at a whole system, or do we look at parts? And what are the consequences of the way that we approach reality from either a systems view or picking things apart in little bits? And I was thinking of Robin Kimmerer's Braiding Sweetgrass and how she talks about the botanical world, everything being interrelated and everything depending on something else. And this is becoming more familiar to us, but our whole science world has been built on parts, and it's become very destructive. And so when I listen to Jackie, when she comes on your program, there's this amazing tissue that she seems to be drawing from of connection with her people and respect and sensitivity to an entire reality that's invisible to most white people, and how important it is to begin to know our world in that way of, it's almost metaphor, almost getting lost or merging with something in order to know it, experiencing it. I had a teacher, a Jewish rabbi, who said that perhaps the ancient Hebrews knew through metaphor rather than through logic. So rather than distinctions among things, they knew by merging. So, you know, you would, love is like a rose, you would sort of become the rose. and what do you know from that way of being in relationship? And so I just wanted to bring up this way, these different ways of knowing, and how they, it's such a big topic, but how they have such different consequences in our kindness and tenderness towards one another and towards the world. Does any of this make sense?
Oh no, I'm resonating very much with what you're saying. I've been thinking a lot about the problem of intimacy, you know, in relation to the Me Too movement and sexual harassment and, you know, dysfunction and, the idea of taking things as parts as to a whole, you know, you're looking at, you know, it's almost like a machine-like approach rather than an organic, a lover's approach, as it were.
Yeah.
The idea of science, I think, is something to really pursue a discussion about, because I think in all human endeavors, there's still, even in its most alienated form, there still is a something in it that strives for the holistic. So I think, you know, there is something in science, the scientific endeavor, that an element of it that strives for the holistic, you know, so whether it's the Einsteinian attempt to, you know, for a complete explanation of the system. But what you're talking about, I think, is it almost comes after the fact, is how I always kind of looked at it. It's sort of like it's a reconstruction of reality, as opposed to what you're saying, a merging with reality, kind of like, you know, the whole Frankenstein myth. Sort of, that's what the scientific endeavor is sort of like. It's sort of like this, you know, analyzing it and then putting the parts back together after the fact. And I totally, what you're saying is very much along the way that I certainly, you know, in my experiences with, you know, my brief experiences, you know, with Native people, Native culture, certainly taught me those same lessons that you hear from Jacqueline Keeler.
Yeah, and I just to pick up on that Me Too movement and the idea of women as objects. It's a narcissistic approach towards another. Just to fulfill needs, the instrumentality of the human, turning the human being into an instrument of your own gratification, rather than seeing the human being as having, I want to say a soul, because I don't really have any other vocabulary, but seeing the human being in their entirety, having been stereotyped, of course, as almost all women have, as just a body, inadequate, your body isn't good enough, or you're just a body because you're just enticement, or whatever it is, instead of having a mind and a spirit and a connection to all beings, sacredness. It's very degrading, and of course that's the attitude that's taken towards the Mother Earth. And I know for people who are, I don't know if we're called postmodernists. I don't know the terminology, Paul, but for those of us who are fully in this time, in this moment, and have all these streams coming through us, and I worked in science as an editor for many years. I worked at MIT for many years, and I watched the students. They would be so fully focused on the parts, and they were brilliant and wonderful, and they were smarter than I ever was about that, but they didn't always think about what are the consequences of what we're doing. How do we fit this into an entire culture? How do we as human beings fit into an entire culture, and what's going to happen to our work?
Well, when we have a culture that is, you know, the capitalist culture was inherently expansionist, so really has no limits. That's the
right.
core of the problem right there. There is no shape to it anymore, as opposed to, you know, I continually sort of hark back to the, you know, the primordial multifamily, you know, clan unit or whatever, which has a distinct shape and a supportive texture and tissue to it, which allows people to grow up in a nurtured way and with a sense of it allows them to become real individuals because they're supported to do that, you know, whether through, you know, a vision quest or some sort of initiation ceremony. And we've really lost both sort of the intimacy of the social network and the possibility of being real individuals, I think, anyway.
Right, you're right, and the depth of inner exploration, that's part of what it means to be a real individual, because the deeper in you go, the more you see you're connected. So I don't want to take up anybody else's time. It's wonderful having the opportunity to speak with you, and thank you for your program, Paul. Have a wonderful day.
Yeah, no, thank you so much, Karen. That was a wonderful conversation, and as are all our conversations here, we'd like to continue them at greater length. We have an hour, though, and we're already at 8:35 in the morning, and this is Wednesday Talk Radio. I am your host, Paul Roland, every Wednesday from 8 to 5. You have different hosts every weekday morning from 8 to 9 o'clock, tackling various subjects, various guests. And let's see who's up next. Michael, go ahead. You're on the air. Hello?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah. I was a philosophy major, too, sort of, in college. And anyway, we have that in common. So, first of all, I think postmodernism was a huge mistake. I think that it's caused an atomization, like, people can't agree on hardly anything because everybody's got their own reality that's inaccessible to you. And a particular example of this that I've run into in my own personal life is Black Lives Matter people, well, people who sympathize with Black Lives Matter, they have two things that they say to people like, I'm a white guy, they have two things they say to people like me. One is, you cannot possibly understand what it's like to be a person of color. That's one. And the other one is, we demand empathy from you, and empathy is the ability to put yourself in the other person's place, which they already told me is impossible. There's no way I can do it.
No, but and wait a second.
What are you supposed to do with that?
Wait a second. But, I mean, I think isn't it true, though, that you can't fully understand what it's like if you don't have black or brown skin, that you can't actually understand what it is to live an entire life where, because you don't have the reactions that you have to you are different than the reactions to someone with black or brown skin has. So that's just on the face of it, kind of a truth that's really indisputable. Now, the ability to actually make an effort to try to understand them, I think that's what empathy is. So you have to make an effort to actually listen to them and try to hear their experiences. And to that extent, then you can have empathy. I don't see those in contradiction.
Well, you know, when they say you can never actually understand, I mean, I could try, but, you know, if you ask too many questions, people tend to get mad at you.
And, well, maybe it depends what the question is.
And you know, I've seen messages from the people that are involved in that sort of movement, like, it's not up to us to educate you. Go and figure it out yourself. And, you know, well, you told me it's impossible for me to understand. You're not going to help me understand. You want me to just go off and figure it out by myself? And, like, you know,
maybe it's maybe that? Michael, maybe it's your attitude. Maybe that's the problem.
Well, maybe it's my attitude. Does my attitude sound like?
Well, I don't know, because I've been able to have good conversations and be able to you know, hear what you know, black and brown people are saying about their experiences. So maybe you shouldn't just react initially and sort of give it a chance.
Well, you know, I've tried hard, and
okay,
I've tried hard, and people have even sort of said, well, yeah, you know, you're not like those other people who just reject what we're saying out of hand, but then, I don't know, they don't want to take the trouble to talk to me or whatever. And, you know, and I think it goes back to the connection, I think, is it goes back to postmodernism. If you posit that we're so separate that, you know, our perspectives can never commingle, then you sort of rejected the possibility that we're going to understand each other.
Well, no, actually, you know, I was being somewhat contentious there, and I agree. Part of me agrees with part of the thrust of what you're saying, which is that we have been split into. But the reason, though, I think I don't agree with you about the reasons why we've been split, perhaps. And I think the reasons why we've been split is because we live in a white supremacist society that creates the conditions under which black and brown people and women and gay people and other people feel that they are not given a chance to express their full humanity, so they react in ways that, you know, might not be always, you know, the best to create a universal struggle. But the problem is that they've been burned so many, tend to have been burned so many times by, you know, often people with, you know, white skin who seem like maybe they get it, but then they really don't. And there's not, and, you know, a lot of the problem is there's just not enough, there just aren't enough situations and time and spaces where people are able to really work through this stuff to, it seems like, the way that you really want to work through it. So that I think what we have to do is create time and space and situations where we can actually really engage with each other and work through what it seems like are these barriers that you're talking about. And I agree that there are barriers on all sides, and we have to find some way to work through them.
Yeah, well, I try by approaching it the best way I can approach it. But, like, for instance, a very smart guy I know gave me this article, and it was an article about a guy who, I think he was a white guy who had been born in South Africa, and then he went off to England for a while, and then he inherited a farm. So he comes back to this farm, and there are all these black people who live on the farm, and he's like the white owner, but he wants to do the right thing. And so he tries to be nice and kind to the people who are there on the farm, and it just doesn't work out. It's like there's a gap, and it just doesn't work out. And finally, the guy is a psychoanalyst, by the way. In England, he became a psychoanalyst. He decides to apply his psychoanalytic skills to the situation, and they start digging into the history of who lived here when and everything that happened, and they dig up old villages, and he gets all these people involved in this archaeological thing of, like, well, what's the history here, and how did this all happen? And it ends up that it really brings them all together in, like, a great way. It's a
yeah,
cool
that was
article.
That was a pod. It was also a podcast I heard on OPB.
Oh, really?
Yeah. No, that
Which
that was
podcast?
Really. What's that?
Which podcast?
I can't remember exactly. It was I don't think it was This American Life. I don't think I can't remember. It might have been not Reveal. I don't know. I'm sure if you go to, if you Google it. But anyway, that is a great story, and I think that's a lesson that we could learn here. And you know, you need. I mean, he had the advantage, you know, and really the privilege of having enough money and having the land to be able to create that kind of experiment and situation. Unfortunately, yeah, Not too many do. But anyway, hey Michael, we got a whole bunch of people still now on the phone, wanting to continue the conversation, and so I thank you for calling.
Bye bye.
Yeah, thank you for calling, and yes, these are difficult social conundrums that we live in or dealing with. Let's see. I think who do we have up next? Oh, Camila, go ahead, Camila. You're on the air.
I would like to give a kind of thumbnail autobiography in order to give a frame of reference to my comments. Is that okay?
As long as it's not, you know, 15 minutes, maybe a few minutes, yeah?
Okay. I'm 76 years old, my next birthday, February 25th. Like you, I am privileged. My father was a physician. I'm a physician. I'm very well educated. I had 6 years of graduate school studying economics before I went to medical school. In college, I majored in government. So really the only philosophy that I've studied had to do with the philosophers who write about government. But I'm well read. I'm a psychiatrist, retired psychiatrist. And 2 years ago, at the age of 74, I discovered Buddhism. And I'd say that's probably the most profound experience I've had in my long life. And it's a life of essentially service, concern for other people and helping them solve their problems. And since I've been retired, I've mostly been a social justice activist. And I think Buddhism might be relevant to this discussion. I'm not exactly sure what postmodernism is. I'm not exactly sure what the question is you're asking us to address. But you did say something about sort of the shifts in our society and the shifts that philosophy has taken in the course of these contemporary changes. And Buddhism is a philosophy that is 2,600 years old, essentially intact, essentially carried forward through various lineages to be shared throughout the world today with, you know, some variability, of course. But I believe that what it essentially concerns itself with is epistemology, the study of knowledge. And it deals with how we assess, evaluate, and experience reality. Reality in Buddhism consists of something called the two truths, absolute reality and relative reality, which ultimately turn out to be one and the same. Buddhism is filled with many paradoxes like this, but what it is, it's not really a religion, it's not theistic, it doesn't have any gods, but it is an approach that each individual who practices learns through study, through understanding, and through experience in practice, in sharing with these concepts that have been transmitted to us, and in community with other Buddhists, which help us to figure out how to approach the world, how to approach our lives, how to join compassion and devotion in our relationship to everything that goes on. And you know, you mentioned your involvement with native concepts, and I think that the native concepts in Buddhism share quite a bit. And I guess I'm making a plug for this, and I think that if people were to really appreciate what Buddhism is all about, we'd have a very different world.
Okay. Is that it? Oh, he's gone.
Yeah. Unless you wanted to.
Well, no. I mean, I don't make any
queries.
No, I mean you're making a statement. I'm more into, I guess, what were before the major, you know, religious traditions. Having read some Taoism, I'm almost kind of a little more leaning that way. That strikes me a little bit closer to, you know, the animistic spirit, I guess, which I see as sort of, you know, if one can put a label on or try to impose some sort of linguistic characterization of, you know, even saying native, I mean, there's each people is is, was different. And of course, they've also changed. So, you know, these are very difficult. But I think, yeah, I mean, I've read some Buddhism. I'm appreciative of some of it. I mean, I think, you know, I think the institutionalization of any religion is problematic. You know, I'm not really into institutionalization. I mean, I think that, you know, we need to get back to more organic sort of or social organization, which seems quixotic and utopian, given that we're, you know, seem to be going further and further along this disastrous course of alienated mass society. But I think within that, you know, and I think Buddhist fellowship, the Sangha, I know you belong to that, you've talked about that, I think is a, you know, is a good place for people to find that communion, that small group socialization, which I think is so essential. So no, I think it, to me, it might lead to a different place eventually, but you know, these are the kind of incredibly complex discussions that definitely can't really happen on the air. I mean, if you want to have a quick response, and then we got some other people to on staff.
Yeah, I just say I'd be careful about any generalizations about Buddhism, because it has a lot of variation. But the ultimate thing that I'd like to say about it is that one of the essential beliefs, particularly in Zen, is to try to eliminate all discrimination, and that's between all categories, including elements that are stone and water and various species and genders and races. And I'd say that that's a fundamental belief that I hold, and I think would be appreciated in these fragmented times.
But don't you only get there when you reach nirvana?
No, I think it's part of the Dharma that we all study.
Okay.
But being able to comprehend it, that's why it's called a practice. It takes study and effort, and ultimately not so much effort as relaxation.
Well, that kind of gets along with what Karen was saying in terms of you know, breaking things down as opposed to seeing the whole. That's very similar.
I would agree with that.
Okay, well, on that note, thank you for calling, Camilo. Appreciate that. We got a couple more people, and we've got 8 minutes or 6 minutes left. Thank you.
Okay.
Elliot is up next.
Yes. My comment I want to make on your show, because I think some cable programmers are less committed to real free speech than I perceive you are. And my comment concerns the 50th anniversary of KABU and how to truly recognize it. And it's based on the biographical fact that I'm a New York transplant, and I have pretty accurate information about the events originating in New York that are leading Pacifica to face imminent bankruptcy, which might actually take a lot of your syndicated cable programming off the air.
Where is that at now? What did has Pacifica? I heard Pacifica was actually going to file for bankruptcy, which would.
Well, yeah. I mean, one of your other tenured producers, you know, immediately snapped at me that they got a loan. The situation, you know, was created by enormous long-term mismanagement, and the underlying reality is that you know, there's been just a steady erosion of audience that you know, basically life-tenured people throughout the network, you know, simply don't care about, because You know, they're rather narcissistic. But the focal issue is that they knowingly allowed the station in New York with almost no audience and no donations to, you know, compile a huge debt as well as a series of other less pressing debts that amount to a huge amount of money, like $8 million. And they have a ethically questionable insider trading kind of offer of a partial high-interest loan by an insider, which doesn't really solve anything. But the reason that I'm calling and I want to make a kind of dissident statement is, you know, WBAI's 50th anniversary occurred about, you know, 8 years earlier than KBOO's.
And? Whoop. Well, that was weird. That ended abruptly. Well, we've only got like 3 minutes left, and we got Corey up, I believe. Hello?
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, no, my name is James, not Corey.
Okay, well, I guess Corey dropped out. Just like,
oh, that's cool.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, no, it, you know, I think I didn't catch what the initial question was, but it sounds like it's like one thing, things we can do to kind of repair where we're going, where we're headed. And, you know, that last caller who was talking about Buddhism, and while I do agree with a lot of tenets of it, I feel like trying to come up with a one-size-fits-all solution to all of our problems is not the way. You know, we need to be able to, like you said, we need to get in touch with our own native traditions. And, you know, because I'm, you know, I for, you know, not everybody's going to agree with the same thing, but we can all agree that we all rely on the same things, and no matter how we get there, regardless of our beliefs or how we interact with the land, you know, we can at least agree on, you know, the basic tenets of what we need to be able to survive. And, you know, I always feel like it's just another way. I feel like, you know, trying, like, you know, telling people that Jesus is the way for everybody, you know, same way of telling people that, you know, Buddhism or this way or that way. And it's like there were hundreds of other traditions before Buddhism and Christianity became mainstream. So I just feel like if we can get back to a place where we can appreciate each other's differences, we can definitely make things better.
Okay, I can't disagree with that.
Cool.
Well, thank you very much for calling in. And we had Mike, but gosh, we really only have a minute, so I think I'm just going to have to call it there. I'm not sure what happened to our dissident caller about WBAI. He was about to make a statement that I wanted to hear. So maybe he can call me at the front desk afterwards, and we can talk about that. The number is 503-231-8032. If you're still listening, call me up because I'm working the front desk after that, which kind of goes as a general invitation. I hope everybody doesn't call me there because I have to actually answer the phones and greet people at the door. But it's always kind of nice to continue conversations afterwards. So that's that. And this has been a really interesting conversation. Sorry I didn't get to Mike, and looks like a couple people dropped off. But generally, I think we had a very, to some extent, continuing conversation, I think, largely. And so I appreciate that. I appreciate people listening and responding thoughtfully. That's what this show is all about. And I thank you. So this is Paul Rowland with Wednesday Talk Radio. Stay tuned for more great programming here on KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Fix-It Fair on Saturday, January 27th, 9:30 a.m. at George Middle School in Portland. The Fix-It Fair helps you learn simple ways to save money and connect with resources. Join your neighbors and talk to the experts about how to spend less and stay healthy. There will be exhibits and hourly workshops on water and energy savings, food and nutrition, neighborhood and community resources, weatherizing your home, transportation, a repair cafe, and much more, with childcare and lunch provided. Again, that's the Fix-It Fair on Saturday, January 27th, 9:30 a.m. to 2:30 p.m. at George Middle School, 10,000 North Burr Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the 28th Annual Cascade Festival of African Films from February 2nd through March 3rd. The Cascade Festival of African Films shows us Africa through the eyes of Africans, rather than a vision of Africa packaged for Western viewers. The films represent different countries and cultures and a range of lifestyles from pre-colonial to modern times, including both rural and urban settings. Films include 76 and The Footprints of Pan-Africanism and more at the Hollywood Theater, and The African Who Wanted to Fly, Foreign Bodies, Wulu, and many more at the Moriarty Arts and Humanities Building, Room 104 at the PCC Cascade Campus, 705 North Killingsworth Street in Portland. Again, that's the 28th Annual Cascade Festival of African Films from February 2nd through March 3rd. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is Ursula K. Le Guin, and you are listening to KBOO, the cheerful voice of social conscience, KBOO, Portland.
And with that, I'd like to remind listeners that this is listener-supported community radio, and you can get involved.